Welcome to Packet Pushers, a podcast on the data networking industry where real people discuss events, technology and work life in the networking industry. This is show 29, and this week we're continuing on the conversation from the previous show where Scott Lowe, Ivan Pepelniak, Ethan Banks and myself talking about Layer 2 data center interconnections. Last week's show looked at the challenges of extending Layer 2 data networks between sites, the threats of large-scale fault domains at Layer 2 spaces, discussions of emotion, latency, more about latency, and then various other discussions about the fundamentals. And although we covered a lot of discussion on the actual problems, we didn't cover too much on the solutions, and Scott left us with a question, which was how do we actually go about that? That led us then into a discussion about VMware vClouds and their networking. Are we using network overlays, using Mac encapsulation? Then we talked something about OTV, then went on into a fairly solid discussion of VEPA and its impact, potential impacts. A lot of it was just rampant prognostication, and I think some of my comments are even incorrect. More to come. Check my blog for details. And then we also had a quick discussion about the impact of virtual appliances replacing physical appliances for networking. So, without further ado, back to the show from last week, where Scott asked the question.
I'm hearing lots of reasons why we shouldn't. But let's kind of bring this back again and say, for better or worse, this is where the industry is headed. So how do we protect ourselves? I mean, the four of us can sit here, and I absolutely agree with everything you guys are saying. There's lots of challenges here. The four of us can sit here and say, you know, hey, we shouldn't do this. These are all the problems that are going to happen. But the reality is that, you know, the industry is headed in that way. For a company who says, this is what I want to do, and you've advised them and they said, I understand the risks. How do I mitigate those risks to the best of my ability? I mean, what, you know, does OTV help some of this? I mean,
no.
Or, you know.
No.
Okay.
OTV is just the simplest technology to bridge. It's conceptually similar to what F5 is doing. So it's bridging over IP and you don't have all the intermediate layers that you have to care about. Like the thing I've been describing.
Is it doing a full Mac frame encapsulation in IP? I've forgotten what OTV is.
Yeah, it's layer 2 packet in IP.
Yeah.
OTV is Mac in IP. So it encapsulates Mac in IP.
Yeah.
And it has some very nice enhancements based around NHRP and packet replication for multicast and broadcast. So if you receive an Ethernet broadcast, it will, and you've got a multi-point destination, so not just two data centers, OTV scales to 4 or 6 or 8, and it does packet replication in the OTV edge device under certain circumstances, yeah.
But it doesn't help with the concept of, you know, broadcast a potential broadcast storm in one data center affecting the other.
Well, the one thing it does solve is it stops the unknown unicast flooding.
Okay.
So the scenario I was describing before with UDP stream going to an unknown destination, that would stop with OTV.
Okay. Yep. But some of the other problems that we discussed, I mean, how many of the other problems that we discussed specific to
there
networking.
Are some things
not
you can do.
Not taking into account, you know, the fact that this data center connect link is usually also carrying fiber channel and also carrying other things, but just within the context of the networking side, what other problems does it help solve, if any?
None.
Okay. That's a fair question. That's what I want to know. I mean, I was just going to say, I get questions from people all the time that are saying, oh, well, I'm going to deploy OTV, and it's like some, you know, it's some magic, you know, bullet, a silver bullet. You shoot OTV at your network, and all of a sudden your data centers are happy, and everybody's, you know, going around, you know, singing and butterflies and all that wonderful jazz. It's kind of like, you know, people consider vPlex to be the same thing for their storage. You know, put vPlex in the mix, and everything's great. And they're both great products, but the reality is that there are still considerations, and so I guess I'm really interested in knowing what are the considerations. You know, what does it fix and what does it not fix?
Okay, so let's go through what it does fix. First, it's relatively simple compared to all the other crazy methods. So it's simpler to understand, it's simpler to configure. Next, it stops the spanning tree. So with OTV, you have a, if you want, split horizons bridging. Whatever is coming from the WAN side will never go back to the WAN side. So you don't need the spanning tree on the WAN side. And so you don't need the spanning tree between the data centers, which means that if you have one data center melting down because of spanning tree problems, the other data centers stay up.
Which removes one of the risks.
Absolutely.
That we were talking about earlier of the layer two fault domains being extended between sites.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Right. And it provides multi-point functionality. So there were solutions where you could stop the spanning tree, but it only worked if you had two data centers. OTV does the same thing even if you have more than two because of the split horizon bridging.
Another advantage of OTV is that it uses IP WAN connections. So you can take your existing layer 3 connectivity between site to site. You can go into that IP packet and you can say, right, I'm going to give OTV 200 megabits out of a 1 gigabit interconnect between two data centers, and that's your layer 2 pipe size.
Yeah, Greg, but you can also do that with Ethernet over PseudoWire, over MPLS, over GRE, over IP.
And right there, you've actually got a problem because acceptance for that technology is pretty rare, because at that point, it's actually easier to deploy VPLS.
Exactly.
Unless you go and buy a VPLS service from a carrier. But
oh, no, let's not go there.
No, no. You can't trust a carrier to run a VPLS service. Scott, did we answer your questions? So there's three things that OTV does. One is it's seductively simple, and it's nice to believe that, you know, Cisco has actually, you know, magically incanted some spell that solves all the problems, but it actually doesn't. The problems don't go away. It mitigates some key factors. It says two spanning tree domains in two data centers, and we'll sort out the loops. As Ivan very accurately sums it up, split horizon bridging. The second thing it does is that it does support some packet replication facilities under certain rather specific circumstances. You have to enable an SSM multicast backbone for it to work, but OTV can perform packet replication for more than two data centers, so it scales up for a larger solution. And the third thing is that OTV runs over your existing layer 3 WAN interconnections. So if you already have a gigabit pipe between your two data centers, a redundant one, then OTV can use that. So it's easy to deploy. It's deceptively simple, but you still have these problems with layer 2 domains. A broadcast generated on the left data center is still broadcasted into the right data center. A VM machine that moves from the left to the right then has the traffic tromboned from the left to the right and then from the right back to the left to be presented to the client. It doesn't answer how do you actually then flip the front end to follow the VM. Faulty NICs, those types of things that generate, you know, layer 2 traffic will be faithfully replicated across the WAN regardless. And so still a single fault domain. So the only another advantage that you have with OTV is it becomes a natural filtering point. So you actually can start to apply controls and say only these MAC addresses will be allowed over this link, so that you can start to apply MAC address filtering on that OTV edge device. It makes a natural point of control. But that requires an enormous amount of discipline to be able to sit there and identify every MAC address for every guest OS that needs to go between sites.
Yeah, and although the MAC address typically won't change, there are circumstances where it can and will change, which then introduces additional overhead in managing it.
Yes, because OTV is not integrated into vCenter, and if you suddenly install a new guest OS and you put it into this class of ownership, it doesn't go off and change the OTV access list configuration to say this one's allowed to VM between sites. And because the vKernel interface is in a different place, you can actually VM it, you can actually vMotion it, but then suddenly find that it's not working.
Right, and that's because a whole other discussion.
That's a whole other discussion.
Yeah, but if we go back to the original reason why we want to do this, and the only good reason we've identified is disaster avoidance, then wouldn't the right thing to do be to have these things prepared, test them every now and then, but only use them, well, deploy them and use them for a short time while you are moving the data center?
Yes, I think one of the things that we could agree is that as a pinch, for a handful of machines, you know, that you've got a bunch of critical servers. You couldn't do it for everything. So it's not a cloud computing technology in any way, shape, or form, to my mind, in that it wouldn't scale up to hundreds of hosts. But for an enterprise, a typical corporate company that's got 3,000 to 5,000 servers, and they've got 50 critical servers that need to be able to be our vMotion between site because of some reason, it could work for that, I think. I think you could apply controls and restrictions, you know, arbitrary ones, notwithstanding, but you could apply controls that could make it work.
Yeah, and Greg, you wouldn't need the VLANs stretched for all the time. When you decide to move, you stretch the VLANs, you move, you cut the cord back to the original data center.
So that the VLANs are only present in the destination data center?
Yes.
Assuming you would vacate an entire VLAN at a time.
Exactly. Okay. But we are talking about disaster avoidance, right?
Yeah, and in that context, you could say, look, there's a hurricane coming or a flood or whatever, right? You could make it a requirement to say, I'm going to vacate an entire VLAN and then essentially transport the VLAN from data center A to data center B, and it won't be in data center A anymore.
Exactly.
Which I guess would address your traffic trombone issue.
Yeah.
Because the routing table, or I guess as you would say, Greg, the routing table, would be updated to point clients across the WAN back to the updated location in data center B.
Yes.
Well, it also assumes all the components of the application were moved as well, the SQL backend, whatever else might be attached. Because part of that traffic trombone is not just the client-facing stuff, but also the back-end stuff that makes up that whole integrated application.
So yeah, you have to start thinking about applications as holistic units, not as and recognizing that an application may consist of five different servers, and those five different servers may be in five different VLANs. So then you add a whole other layer of complexity to how you vacate applications from one data center to another because of all these interdependencies.
Yeah, yes. Exactly. I don't think we fixed anything. We haven't fixed any problems at all today.
But now we understand the problem.
Yeah, I mean, if for no other reason, it was great to get on and get a better view of the concerns and the considerations around it. I'm perhaps a little more networking aware than a lot of my peers in the virtualization industry. Mm. And so I was kind of already aware of some of these things, and I've pointed out articles by Greg and Ivan as well, you know, regarding traffic trombone and some of these other considerations, so that, you know, this wasn't completely new to me, not all of it anyway.
Well, Cisco is very hopeful about OTV. They've got a competitive edge. And so they're going to sing that song very loudly, and rightly so. It's a good technology, and as far as it goes, there are a number of competitive products against it. I believe that HP and Brocade, and I could easily be wrong here, so don't jump on me, have equivalent technologies that provide these answers. But there is an open source technology. Sorry, there's existing MPLS technologies that provide layer 2 interconnects, but they're in the realms of carriers. However, the carriers don't usually engineer their networks with sub-millisecond latencies engaged between sites, so they're not normally the answer. So carriers will try and sell you a VPLS service or a layer 2 interconnect, but it'll have 500 milliseconds of latency because it actually trombones, you know, inside the carrier backbone. It goes via some tortuous loop to get between the two sites that you want to connect. It can't be guaranteed.
Right.
And the carriers can't guarantee you that latency because the network adapts itself on an ongoing basis. They actually have automated systems that redirect the traffic. So the latency between sites can vary at any time. So rule of thumb, you can't buy a layer 2 service from a carrier because you can't trust the carrier to actually know what it's doing and keep it consistent. So you have to have your own answer to this problem. And that's where OTV comes in that you have some level of control over that layer 2 interconnect and you have some visibility into what's going on. Just to jump back to a point a while ago, there are some products out there that can do traffic shaping of layer 2 products. So for example, there's a product now owned by Bluecoat called Packeteer, which can actually do traffic shaping at up to 10 gig on a layer 2 connection. But it's a very difficult product. Well, it's not difficult, but it does require some solid skills to be able to make it go.
It's one of those products that's been around for a long time. It's got a lot of it had a lot of features a long time ago, and it's only gotten more so. Yeah, it's a serious piece of gear.
Yeah, I used to be a trainer for it, so I'm quite comfortable with it. But as one of the sales reps once said to me, he said the problem with this product is that it's rocket science, and to run it, it's rocket science. So it's hard to explain to customers what they want. Or have we got more? Is there anything we've missed?
Well, there's one point I wanted to go back, something you'd hit on earlier, Greg. We started talking about just how big you can scale up a layer two domain. And that is, correct me if I'm wrong, I think you had quoted someone that said, conceptually, we can go as big as 30,000 hosts in the same layer two space. Does that sound about right?
That's my recollection of a conversation with Alwin Sequeira from VMware. Yeah.
I'm just trying to imagine what it is they've got cooking where that's a statement that made any sort of sense. That just boggles my mind. I get really uncomfortable with really much more than a slash 23, let's say. Start going bigger than that, depending on what the hosts are out there. A 1,000 hosts is as much as I dare to conceive of in the same space, sharing the same broadcast domain. 30,000? There's got to be some technology that they want to do. There's got to be some magic that they're doing on the networking back end to make that a plausible scenario, and I want to understand what that is.
Yeah, I'll try and get a hold of him. I'll chase him down. The answer is VMware's vCloud product, which is trying to cloud-enable existing legacy applications, which is a difficult thing to imagine, is easiest to comprehend if you can imagine a very large, very flat VLAN. And it makes it incredibly easy to dynamically provision machines and to DRS them around a data center if there's very large numbers of guest OSs. I think that's the thrust of it. I am by no means a vCloud expert. And, Scott, maybe we should be getting together with the virtualization guys in this forum and doing more podcasts in this area. What do you think?
I think it's a good idea. And one of the things I wanted to catch up with you at some point, and not necessarily today, but I read your article about the Mac approach that vCloud Director was using for their isolated networking and your disagreement, shall we say, with that approach. And I would love at some point to chat more about that and just kind of get a better feeling for, the basis of your concerns. But, I don't want to stretch this session out too long. So maybe we can do that on a future episode.
I've got nowhere to be. Ivan?
Well,
yeah, sure. That would be great.
Ethan, you good?
Yeah, for a bit, yeah.
Your question then revolves around the vCloud product. And in the vCloud, they've decided to create a network overlay configuration tool. So I was at VMworld in Copenhagen, and I sat through a vCloud presentation, vCloud networking. And they talk about a technology inside of that where you can actually create, I can't remember the exact word that vCloud that the VMware people were using, but it was a virtual network in the network. So let's assume that you had a VMware vSwitch and you had physical VLANs being presented from the network. But what you actually wanted was another network just between these two servers in the VMware, in the distributed vSwitch infrastructure. You didn't actually want it to be in the switches. You wanted to create your own VLANs and your own network of guest OSs and present them to a separate VLAN that's not actually in the switches themselves. Then VMware has developed a Mac in Mac technology. So what they actually do there is you create the VLAN in the vSwitch, and when it goes out of the vSwitch, they take the Ethernet frame, encapsulate it in another Mac header or another Ethernet packet, and then egress that into the Ethernet network. So you have what we call Mac in Mac encapsulation. Ivan, tell me why that's a shocking problem.
Well, the first thing you have to realize is that they chose the wrong layer. If they would say, we will encapsulate Mac in IP, I would go like, wow, this sounds good. Because all of a sudden you would have this scalable underlying transport network, and they would be just another application on top of it. Mm-hmm. And it would be great. It would scale. You wouldn't have broadcast problems. You wouldn't have large failure domains. But no, they decided to use Mac in Mac.
Yeah. The other question I have in the back of my mind is, would it break the silicon switching engines? A couple of things.
Where?
Obviously, the other one is you've got oversized Ethernet frames. They're no longer 1,500 bytes.
Oh, yeah, you have jumbo frames.
You've got jumbo frames. So you'd have to have every switch and every link in the network has to be able to handle jumbo frames, which today
has to be jumboized.
Yeah, which today is not true. Most networks
aren't. It has to be capable of it and has to have turned it on, which most switches by default jumbo frames are not there. And then sometimes the jumbo frame capabilities are of different sizes anyway, so not as not a safe assumption to make that jumbo frames is going to work right.
Okay, and the second problem is that when you do enable jumbo frames, it sometimes uncovers other problems in your network, in your existing network. So I've had situations where I've enabled jumbo-sized frames on switches suddenly to discover that there are servers out there that have been generating bad frames for a long period of time, and they suddenly aren't being dropped by the switch, and they're suddenly being propagated across the network and caused other problems. Don't just go along and start configuring jumbo frames on all your switches. You need to be just a little cautious about doing that in and out of hours, as somebody who had a problem, shall we say.
Yeah, and I think that because they use Mac in Mac, the extension of the Mac frame is big enough so that you don't get into the baby jumbo space.
Yeah.
Where you could cheat and insert just a few bytes and some of the switches would swallow that.
Yes.
Here you have the real jumbo frames, so the switch has to support them.
So that would be jumbo frames is one. Mac and Mac is all the issues that we've talked about earlier in the show about scalability and fault domains.
Yeah, the problem is that they assume you have a large bridged domain to use, which we discussed before.
That's right.
Yeah, so it's not necessarily a good assumption to make. Right. So was this Mac and Mac, and we're, I mean, it's speculation for us to say why VMware would do something, but is it a matter of lowest common denominator? Like, this is the simplest thing they could do without requiring some sort of extensive support? I mean,
my nasty angle on this is that they're trying to make the networking piece as easy as possible. So if they would decide to use IP, then someone would have to configure the IP addresses, the IP subnets, the IP routing. If they say just bridge everything, it's plug and play.
Yeah, I see it as a marketing move by VMware to say to the server guys, just do whatever you like. Don't worry about the networking thing. We've got it covered. And to undermine, effectively it undermines the networking thing, because the third area which I was sort of getting to is the security issue. If you suddenly got servers sending data flows from side to side over a layer 2 network that aren't known by other people, you've got a security issue. You could have data being exported from server to a server that you've never seen before. You can also have problems where those frames won't be recognized by an IDS system or a security system. Not that you're likely to do too much, but in terms of a security issue, that creating these overlay networks that sit over the top of other networks, existing networks, can cause great security problems.
Yeah, plus you lose all visibility into what's really going on.
Yes.
The only thing you can do from the networking perspective is you can check your MAC tables, which yet again was a bad decision, because if they would use IP, you would be able to ping across. Yes. And then you would say, okay, this IP can ping the other IP, not my problem, it's your problem.
So I think the vCloud purpose, Scott, I think the idea behind this networking was that you could create a VLAN with 1,000 hosts inside of it. Let's say you had 1,000 VMware servers, and on each VMware server you had 20 guest OSs. Then you can actually start to create networks of guest OSs that have no physical representation on the Ethernet network. The VLANs are purely virtual inside of the VMware space and can be fully controlled and configured by vCloud. And they're using Mac and Mac encapsulation to abstract the network, the physical, the logic, the whole network as it exists, out from vCloud. So everything's done inside of vCloud.
Yes.
So virtual LANs. Yeah.
Right. So I hear everything you're saying about the problems and don't disagree with any of that. I guess looking at it from, or taking a devil's advocate position, looking at it from the other direction, was this a necessary task in order for them to be able to advance? You know, the idea is that we're driving towards this point where we could, and there are lots of challenges that we've been discussing throughout this entire session, we're driving to a point where we could mix and match workloads, workloads potentially running in a colo facility from a provider, as well as workloads running in our own data center. And was this or is this a requirement in order to get past some of the networking complexity that would be necessary to make that work otherwise?
Well, Scott,
you know, I mean, you know, there's a balance between abiding by standards and then driving new standards. And I'm not saying that they're right. Don't get me wrong. I'm just saying, you know, what would have been, aside from doing Mac and IP, what would have been the right way to do this if that's what they wanted to do?
As I said before, if they would go over IP, then your argument would be perfectly valid, because then you could connect to your service provider, you could connect to Amazon, you could connect to whoever. And just using the IP connectivity, build your cloud over it, supposedly.
I think...
Okay, and now Greg, my nasty take again. So what they're trying to do is they're trying to get the bigger chunk of the pie. Well, Greg, it's simpler. They want to be able to use cheap switches so that they can sell more expensive software and the budget stays the same.
Well, yeah. I was just going to say, I've got stuff sitting in my inbox to read about VEPA and the associated protocols that I haven't gotten around, or associated standards that I haven't gotten around to reading yet. So I'll have to have to bump that up on my priority list.
Well, okay, but, VEPA is just the solution for vSwitch. VEPA eliminates vSwitch by pulling the virtual links to the physical switch.
That's correct.
It has nothing to do with vCloud or any of the other things we've been discussing before.
No.
It takes away the vSwitch.
Yes. The idea of switching, of doing any networking inside of VMware is fundamentally flawed, as far as I can see. So the idea behind a vSwitch is that you can have multiple guest OSs in a VMware instance, and they can all communicate to each other on chassis. Okay. What VEPA does is it says, it creates the VEPA standards fundamentally create a signaling layer that occur over the LLDP, communication protocol, where the switch and VMware will signal backwards and forwards about the networking setups that are needed so that there can be a decision about actually sending packets out into the switch, and then the switch will turn it back around and send it to the other guest OS on the same switch. The reason that I maintain that a vSwitch is not suitable in the long term is because the virtual machine doesn't necessarily reside on a physical server. The very point of being a VM is that the server should be able to exist on any VM server in a given network. That is, should be able to dynamically migrate. If you say to me that, oh, but the vSwitch works because it's very much faster inside a given chassis, well, yes, that is a use case and actually quite a corner condition, because the point of VMware is that two servers shouldn't communicate over a vSwitch. They should just communicate across a network. Therefore, the actual switches need to be in play. So I believe at the moment that VMware's vCloud networking, the Mac and Mac overlay network, is a pinch hit while we wait for the networking equipment to catch up. And remember, networking equipment relies on silicon and can't just, you know, hire a bunch of programmers and say, voila. There are, you know, changes that have to happen and take, you know, years of development and testing and manufacturing before they come to market.
Yeah. Well, Greg, you're right and wrong.
Sure.
The wrong part is that if you're willing to sacrifice performance, you can do everything in software. The question is, how much is that costing you? So doing routing in ESX server, doing bridging in ESX server, doing firewalling in ESX server, all that is doable, but it takes away your CPU cycles.
Well, and I would agree with you, Ivan. The question then becomes, though, when we look at where the industry as a whole is headed, is that process of doing everything in software inevitable given the price performance curve of the x86 chipset? Now, merits of the x86 chipset versus dedicated silicon aside, because that is a whole other discussion for a whole other day that could take us several hours. But the reality is that Intel and associated companies continue to expand their footprint, and we see more and more companies that are saying, I'm just going to standardize on x86 because I can do so much with x86 and I can run all my stuff in software rather than spending millions of dollars to build dedicated ASICs. You know, at what point does it become good enough? And then things change. I mean, then, you know, maybe we're not limited by the speed of silicon anymore. Maybe then we're just limited at the speed of development to write functionality onto x86 and then be processed.
Okay, Scott, let me just give you one example. If you want to firewall 10 gig of traffic, there's this product from Cisco, the high-end ESA, and it uses numerous cores to process the traffic. And it still can't do the proper deep inspection at 10 gig, I was told. So if you want to do the same thing in your server, yes, you can do it in software, but that will just eat all the CPU just to firewall the 10 gig pipe that goes out of the server.
The difference there, though, and this is the argument, I have a sort of a vision at the moment that Cisco's walking away from its layer 4.7 appliance marketplace. So we haven't seen Cisco do much with their WAS products or their XML gateways and those sorts of things. And that's because I think Cisco's saying that VMware virtual appliances will take up the load. The advantage of virtual appliances, so running Riverbed WAN acceleration appliances or Bluecoat proxy engines and WAN acceleration in VM instances, is that you can have hundreds of them. So instead of having one big silicon box in one place that firewalls all of the servers in your data center, and therefore it needs to be 10 gig, well, now you can actually have 100 virtual machine running in your network that are your firewall function distributed around 100 VMware servers, which cost you less than an appliance would cost. And therefore, because the workload is highly distributed throughout your data center, it's able to scale to infinitely, you know, scale to sizes as needed.
And the other thing to keep in mind, and you guys probably may not be aware of this. I'm aware of it because we do this day in and day out. But when you look at a company who chooses to virtualize and they take their data center and they go 50% virtualized or 70% or 80% virtualized, the thing that they run up against, that wall that they hit first, it isn't CPU cycles. It's memory. CPU cycles are essentially, you know, a dime a dozen. And, you know, we get more and more cores coming out, more and more, you know, cycles going on. I mean, to me, CPU is like,
infinite.
Like water. Get you a little bit more. Just turn the spigot on and throw in a few more cores, you know. And so I agree with Greg's vision there of having this wave of distributed appliances that are leveraging all these extra CPU cycles that Intel is giving away, essentially, because, you know, they're selling you an octa-core, you know, CPU that runs 8 cores at 3 gigahertz each. I mean, that's 24 gigahertz of processing power on a single die, and you might have 4 of those things inside a box. You know, it's insane.
But if it's not, but the thing is, Scott, and Ivan's point, I almost bet what he's going to say is that if it's not, so they'll solve the memory problem, and then it'll be the CPU problem, and then it'll be the bus architecture.
Well, yeah, anytime you fix a bottleneck in one spot, you just open a bottleneck somewhere else.
Exactly. And we will then, you know, step up to consume more. The advantage of the challenge around these virtual appliances that I'm talking about is that there's no real-time functions. So for networking appliances to work correctly, they cannot be oversubscribed. And the functions, we have to be able to time them. So, for example, an Ethernet packet has an inter-packet gap of 6 milliseconds. So between the end of an Ethernet frame and the start of the next frame, on a link that's running full duplex, is 6 milliseconds of time, where you have that processing gap to be able to make a processing decision about something about the previous packet. You need to update counters and algorithms, and, you know, and those functions all need to be achieved, you know, for QoS tagging and CRCs and, you know, all that sort of stuff that happens to those packets needs to be achieved inside of a finite time interval. It's not elastic. So a SQL server, if it runs out of memory or CPU, it just switches the memory to page, halts what it's doing, and says, hang on, I'm busy, right? I can stop. Whereas a firewall can't stop. It can't just sit there and say, I haven't got any CPU or I haven't got any memory for 250 milliseconds, so I'll just throw that packet away.
Well, it can, but the performance sucks.
Well, I do have to say, Greg, that that description of VEPA is probably one of the best I've heard. So thank you for that.
I have an article which I've been attempting to write for some time. But people haven't grokked onto why VEPA is important, and it's very difficult to sell because all the VMware people can see is the VMware. They can only see what's in front of their face. They can't see the bigger picture.
Well, it seems to me that if we were to adopt VEPA, right, and there's a signaling layer occurring over LLDP between the hypervisor and a process or you know chips or whatever occurring in the switch, then a lot of these issues that we're talking about go away. I mean, at that point, couldn't we just tell the switch, hey, I don't have any VMs that are on this VLAN, so just prune that VLAN off this link and don't even bother to send it to us?
Yes.
And what about vCenter plugins for switches so they can signal backwards and forwards?
Right. I mean, it just seems like, you know, that I never really had a good firm grasp on VEPA. Like I said, I've read the RFCs and some of the other stuff, but, you know, reading those things is crazy. So that's why I appreciate your definition, Greg.
Yep.
Because I ask why aren't we pursuing VEPA more aggressively? Because it seems to me that's the answer.
Okay, the reason we aren't pursuing VEPA more aggressively is that the IEEE is a very difficult body. It's largely ineffective and it's not transparent and it's not open. So we can't see. IEEE is the body that sets the 802.3 standards.
Right.
And we're stuck with it. It's slow and it's grumpy and we get very little visibility. I've tried to have them come on the show and talk about VEPA and they've been very reluctant to do so. The flip side of this is also that Cisco, who owns, you know, a staggering percentage of the marketplace, is not getting onto VEPA. They're not throwing their weight behind it. So that has changed. So with HP's acquisition of 3Com and with Brocade, and this is one area where HP Networking and Brocade and Extreme and all the other networking companies, like all of them, are lining up behind VEPA because it's their chosen strategy for providing virtualized networking that works with VMware and Xen and Hyper-V and providing this switching offload functions and information backwards and forwards between the VMware machines and the switches themselves.
Yeah, but don't forget that for WEPA to work, the first one that needs to support it is VMware.
Of course, yes.
And if they don't support it, it doesn't help you if you have it in the switch.
Okay, other good things about VEPA, no change to existing hardware. It uses existing Mac silicon engines. It's a software change, no change to the packet format. Full legacy integration.
No. Disagree with no change to the packet format.
No, VEPA doesn't modify the frame.
Oh, yeah, there is some tagging in there. Because you have to tell the switch from which virtual interface this is coming. They might use Mac and Mac.
There's a moment of anticipation while Greg looks to see if Google actually has the answer.
No, I'm actually looking at a blog post.
WEPA is which standard?
802.1 QBG and 802.1 QBH.
QBG is WEPA, QBH is port extenders.
Yeah, so 802.1 QBH is vSwitch standardized. It's called VEB, Virtual Ethernet Bridges. And 802.1 QBG is virtual bridging, which is extending the virtual bridge from...
Edge virtual bridging is the
official... And VEPA is virtual Ethernet port adapter, which is the effectively... VEPA almost completely kills Nexus 1000 is also the other thing.
Yes.
Hmm. Well, that would make sense why Cisco doesn't want to support it then.
Yeah, that's right.
Yes.
And every time I mention VEPA, Omar Sultan's on the Twitter going, you had to go and say that, didn't you?
Cisco is supporting QBH because this was something similar to their port extender, the Nexus 2000.
Yes.
Right. That's the technology they're using in the Nexus 2Ks and in the Palo card, right?
No, that's what they claim they're using.
Well, this is the standardized version of what they say they're using.
Exactly.
Right. Okay. Yes. I got you.
Yeah. So here's the way it works. So Vepr and VNTag basically do the same thing. So Cisco uses a VNTag format. And the VNTag insists on adding an additional tag to an Ethernet frame. So it's an actual modification to the MAC frame. And the VNTag is received by a Nexus 2000, 5000, 4000 switch. And their silicon can read that frame and make decisions about what the VNTag. And then you go into the switch and you configure the VN things to happen with the VNTag about what you want to happen. So packets that have this VNTag get managed in this way.
Oops, Greg, sorry to spoil the fun.
Yeah, go right ahead.
This only works today if you have UCS with Nexus 6000.
Correct.
So don't mention 5000 and 2000. It doesn't work on them.
Well, they use the VNTag format.
No. My understanding was that the 5K and the 2K used VNTag, but that wasn't applicable to the VMware use case.
No. That's the marketing story.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
We don't know what know what goes on between Nexus 5K and Nexus 2K. It's proprietary.
Well, it's an example of controller-based networking.
Yeah, but it's proprietary. We don't know whether it's VNTag or not.
Doesn't matter what it is.
Yeah, exactly.
So what Vepr does is it adds a LLDP layer to signal information between the two so that you can actually say, I want my vSwitch to look like this, and these are the MAC addresses that are on my system, and here's the ones that exist in a virtual Ethernet, this vSwitch and this switch, these are in this vSwitch, and these are the VLANs that I need, and all that sort of stuff.
Yes.
And because it doesn't modify the MAC, the frame, the Ethernet frame, it's all done at a higher layer. It works with all existing switches. They just have to understand software. So what it means is that if you have an existing network today of Ethernet switches, only the devices connected to the VMware servers have to change because they need to speak LLDP with Vepr extensions. So all of your existing Ethernet switches will work and packets can traverse. Whereas with Cisco networking, with the VNTag format, they've got a proprietary tag inserted. So you have to connect to a Nexus device that strips the VNTag before sending it across the core network, or forklift out all of your existing switches so that they can forward the VNTag. And further, because they insert an additional tag into the MAC frame, all of your existing silicon becomes obsolete because you cannot accept a VNTag in an existing switch because the frame's no longer able to be switched in silicon. In fact, it's not switched at all. It just gets discarded because it doesn't match the MAC format correctly.
But LLDP support alone is not enough to make this work. It has to be Vepr on top of LLDP.
Yes.
And Vepr is the agreed set of functions that so LLDP is just like saying, it's like you and me saying,
it's a standardized version of it's a standard, essentially, as it's been described to me, it's a standardized version of CDP that everybody can get behind.
Well, LLDP is like PPP negotiation. You can negotiate whatever you want.
Okay. And then Vepr just standardizes or specifies what you're going to be negotiating.
Exactly.
Yeah. Specifies a bunch of TLVs, type length variables.
Okay.
And the type length variables are, name, VEB, VEB1, VEB2, VEB3. I've got three VEBs, and it signals over to the other one, and here's the names of the VEBs. And you want to create this here and this, that, and this and that. And there's just a whole bunch of backwards and forwards stuff that gets encoded into a type length variable, TLV. And then the software on the switch says, right, I'm going to go and program my forwarding table to do this. And the VMware server says, oh, I can see I've got all that. And then there's an acknowledgement, and that's positive. That's a positive. Oh, that failed. Signals that back to the vCenter server so that you can see that the networking's working or not. And then the vCenter server can then have a plugin, which then queries the switch then for its configuration information. So to my mind, we will solve the networking challenges. So come right back to where we were. The Mac in Mac requirement of the vCloud gives us a working solution today in software, which is suboptimal, reduces security, reduces visibility, and causes long-term challenges in your existing network architecture around jumbo frames. The long-term fix is for the networking industry to catch up, which is on a much longer development cycle than VMware, and technologies that perhaps Vepr will win, and perhaps there's something else that I don't know about that's going to come along, that will deliver these functionalities that will support the new features that VMware wants.
Okay, awesome.
Gosh, it's quiet in here.
You said everything that there was to say.
Yeah, the networking industry is awesome. What else do you want to know? All right. Anything else, Scott?
No. You guys, it's just been a blast. I've learned a lot.
Well, I'll look forward to setting up something with you around. I wouldn't mind having a discussion around FCOE sometime.
Yeah, sure. That'd be a blast.
Yeah, I'm not anti it, but I just want to talk about it so that networking people can understand it. I think there's a whole bunch of Fibre Channel stuff in here that we should talk about. You know, how Fibre Channel forwarders and, you know, VN links and, you know, all the different types of ports and things like that. And I think it could be a great introduction for networking people who listen to the show to talk about it if you've got some time.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You let me know when.
Okay, for sure. And I also wouldn't mind setting up another one where we have the virtualization people tell the networking people something.
Okay.
Like, well, you know, you've brought your questions to the networking. We should do one back the other way and say, let's bring our networking questions to the virtualization people and get you and somebody else in the VMware space to hammer it out.
Yeah, absolutely. That would be a blast as well. Yeah, me too.
Scott, is your book, the book you were working on, totally done at this point?
So we were working on an update to Mastering VMware vSphere 4 that was going to be keyed for the 4.1 release that VMware had earlier in the year. Because of the timeframes for publishing the book, the publisher decided they wanted to cancel that project. So there will not be an update to Mastering for 4.1. We will be doing an update for the next major release, whenever that happens, from VMware. I am working on another book project with a couple of authors that we're not, we haven't determined exactly when and how we're going to announce that. It is obviously a VMware-centric title. That should be due out, let's say, early next year, probably like January, maybe February. It'll come out. And that's going to be a collaborative effort between myself and two other authors.
Ethan, have we stunned you into insensibility? I know I have. I'm my eyes are glazing over.
No, my eyes are definitely glazing over, and you guys kicked off the VEPA discussion, which I have not done really any reading or homework on. So sadly, I was like just a participant at that point. Hey, listen to them talk about cool stuff. Yay.
That's it for the show this week, and thanks for listening to Packet Pushers. We should be back again in a week or so. Make sure you come back. I'd like to thank our guests for joining us this week. Scott, what are you doing this week, and where can we find you?
Well, this week I'm just spending some time in the lab, so lots of MDS and Nexus and VPlex configuration, and I imagine that everything that I end up playing with this week will find its way onto my blog at blog.scottlow.org, and you can also follow me on Twitter as Scott_Low.
And also, Ivan Pemniak, what are you doing this week, and where can we find you?
You can find me at blog.ioshints.info. or on Twitter at iOSHints, obviously. And this week, I'm just polishing the final details for the MPLS webinar on Thursday. That's it.
Hey, I'm going to be there for that one, too.
I know.
I promise I won't taunt you too much.
That's good. Thank you.
Because I know nothing about MPLS. I'm quite keen to learn some more. I know the webinars are going pretty well. They're becoming quite popular, I believe.
Oh, yeah, they are. I'm amazed.
And, of course, Ethan, what are you doing this week?
Putting the finishing touches on a project plan to migrate from one public-facing external IP block to another, which is going to break everything because that's just the way these things go. It doesn't matter how good you plan. You convert over that new block and you spend the next 2 weeks recovering from all the crap that no one can connect to anymore. You didn't hard code that in a host file, did you? A host what? Yeah. Okay. Well, tell you what, open up this file and edit it. Anyway, I'll be blogging about that and whatever else at packetattack.wordpress.com. And, of course, I tweet nerdy at EC Banks.
And I'm Greg Farrow, and you can find me at etherealmind.com or on Twitter as @etherealmind. I'm in the final weeks of my current job, and next week I'll be taking some time off over Christmas and unemployed next year. I'm not sure where it's going to take me, but that's where I'm going. So we'd love to hear your feedback about the show. Send emails. Follow us on Twitter as @PacketPushers or go to the podcast website at packetpushers.net. And remember, too much networking would never be enough.